Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Dorothy Gundy, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
In October 2016, the head of Russia's largest oil company traveled to the birthplace of Hugo Chavez, the former president of Venezuela. Rosneft chief executive officer Igor Sechin brought with him a singing group from Moscow to celebrate the presentation of a huge statue of the former leader. Chavez had died 3 years earlier. Sechin's visit marked a turning point in the relationship between Russia and Venezuela. He spoke to a crowd of government supporters in Spanish, which he learned in his days working for the Soviet military in Africa. "We have no choice between victory or death," said Sechin, repeating the words of a Venezuelan independence hero. He was describing the deepening ties between Russia and Venezuela in their competition with the United States. "We must achieve victory," he said. Now the U.S. government wants to break up that growing partnership as part of its campaign to remove Chavez's replacement, Nicolas Maduro.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Treasury Department barred American companies from doing business with Rosneft Trading, S.A. It accused the company, the subsidiary of Russia's state-owned oil business, of supporting Maduro as he seeks to avoid U.S. sanctions. For months, U.S. officials have been warning foreign companies that they could face action if they continue to do business with Maduro and his government. Those warnings have been directed mainly at Russia. The U.S. government made it illegal for Americans to buy crude oil from Venezuela a year ago. And government officials say Russia has processed about 70% of Venezuelan oil sales since that time. Francisco Manaldi is a Venezuelan oil expert at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He told the Associated Press the latest actions should cause concern among companies in countries that continue to partner with the Venezuelan state-operated oil company, PDVSA. The U.S. action could also lead to the ending of a special license for Chevron. The permit has so far kept the California-based company from having to pull out of Venezuela. Chevron is a partner in joint operations with PDVSA. Together, they are responsible for about a fourth of Venezuela's total oil production.
In a statement, PDVSA condemned the U.S. government for what it called economic assassination, aimed at taking control of Venezuela's oil industry. Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the new actions would support Venezuela's case against the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Venezuela is accusing the administration of crimes against humanity and is taking the case to the International Criminal Court. Rosneft operates several oil fields with PDVSA that it has controlled since Chavez's government forced U.S. companies out of the country. But oil experts say that as the new go-to supplier of the country's crude oil supplies, Rosneft wins two ways. First, Rosneft buys Venezuela's high-quality Medellín 16 crude at a greatly reduced cost. It then uses money from sales of Medellín 16 to pay down $6.5 billion lent to PDVSA since 2014 for the purchase of Russian-made weaponry and other goods. To avoid problems for buyers in China and India, Rosneft has been using oil transport ships that try to hide what they are carrying. They turn off their required tracking systems and carry out risky ship-to-ship exchanges off the coast of West Africa and other areas. In the short term, Francisco Manaldi expects Maduro will have to pay more to find someone else to take on the added risk of moving the country's oil. That means Venezuela will have even less money to import food and medical supplies or repair its failing electricity infrastructure. And with storage centers already full, production that is already at a 70-year low is likely to fall even further, he added.
Still, nobody expects oil sales from Venezuela to dry up completely. That is, unless the U.S. Navy blocks all of the country's ports. The Trump administration has refused to deny it will do so, but has shown no sign of taking that action. The United States leads a group of now nearly 60 nations that recognize Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as the country's rightful leader. The group considers Maduro's 2018 re-election illegal. In turn, Russia has accused the Trump administration of spreading false information to engineer an overthrow of the government. Richard Nephew is an energy researcher at Columbia University in New York. He helped design the U.S. sanctions policy while at the State Department during the presidency of Barack Obama. Nephew said by not dealing with Rosneft itself, and only going after one of its many parts, the effect on Russia's continued support for Maduro will likely be limited. This seems more like a warning shot designed to look bigger than it actually is, he noted. It's shooting someone who is Russian sounding without really punishing the Russians themselves. Several pro-Putin lawmakers were dismissive of the Trump administration's efforts. They said they would appeal to the World Trade Organization to remove what they described as unlawful U.S. actions. I think this issue can be resolved, Vladimir Dzhabarov, a member of Russia's upper house of parliament, told RIA Novosti news agency. They're smart over there in Rosneft, and they will find a way to get around it. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Everyone, today, let's start the program with a question. What is your city famous for making? I'll tell you my answer. New York is famous for making great pizza. Here's another question that follows the same structure. What are you excited about learning? I hope your answer is how to make sentences that use adjectives followed by prepositions and gerunds. That is the topic of today's Everyday Grammar program. Without even realizing it, you may already know several adjectives that use this sentence structure. Let's look at three of them today. Interested, excited, and bored. Now, listen to two sentences that use the adjective bored and think about which sounds more natural.
Noemi was bored of doing the same job. Noemi was bored to do the same job.
Hopefully, the first sentence sounds more natural to you. If so, your ears are probably accustomed to hearing the structure we are exploring today. Be plus adjective plus preposition plus gerund. In the sentence, was is the verb of being. Bored is the adjective. Of is the preposition, and doing is the gerund. You may remember that a gerund is a verb form that ends in ing and acts as a noun. If the second example sounds more natural to you, you are likely in the habit of making the common mistake of using an infinitive after some adjectives. You may remember that the infinitive form of a verb is to plus its simplest form, as in to do. But think of the adjective plus preposition structure as a signal that some kind of noun will follow, such as a gerund or noun phrase, not an infinitive verb. Okay, so I mentioned the adjectives interested, excited, and bored. Now, let's look at the prepositions that usually come after them. Listen for the word that follows interested in the next example.
He is interested in studying abroad.
The word in is the only preposition that can come after the adjective interested. I cannot say, for example, I am interested about studying abroad. The good news is that even though the grammar is not correct, the listener would probably still understand my meaning. Now listen for the preposition in this example.
I am excited about learning to play the guitar.
I hope you noted the preposition about. It almost always follows the adjective excited. Finally, listen for the preposition in this example.
They were bored of staying inside all day.
That's right. Bored of usually goes together. As you can see, in English, specific prepositions follow specific adjectives. Before we go, let's briefly hear what today's examples sound like in the negative form. Here are the three examples.
He is not interested in studying abroad. He plans to travel after he finishes school.
Noemi was not bored of doing the same job. She learned something new every day.
I am not excited about learning to play the guitar. My father is making me do it.
Can you see how to form the negative? Simply add the word not between the be verb and the adjective. But keep in mind that most native English speakers use contractions, so in real life, the sentences would probably sound more like, he's not interested in studying abroad, and Noemi wasn't bored of doing the same job. So, what can you do to practice the grammar we talked about today? Here's one idea. Try to familiarize yourself with a list of about 20 of the most common adjectives that are followed by prepositions. Then, listen and look for those adjectives whenever you hear and read English. Ask yourself if the speaker or writer is using the sentence structure from today's lesson. You can also practice writing your own sentences, and then use them when you speak or write English to friends or practice partners. While today's topic is fresh in your mind, here's a great way to practice right now. Answer one, two, or all of these questions. What is your city famous for making? What are you excited about learning? What are you not bored of doing? I am very, very interested in reading your answers. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. We continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932.
President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer. But he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem. But he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need, but he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation. They accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget. And he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. He did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political adviser, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. He made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget, but he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.